clean it, forget it. With soybeans in it for protein, and we'll push it as a soft drink in the ghetto.
If you feel you're healed.
Dad, I don't want to die anymore.
Then behave yourself!
I have a job for you. 2 tons of turquoise to Taos tonight.
Let your mind go. Let your body go. Let your wallet go.
When in doubt, out!
You're talking about manslaughter. That's against the law.
Are you paranoid or something?
How dare you call me a nymphomaniac?
You can't eat an air conditioner.
No sh**!
Who did that?
You did. It was your idea.
Not bad.
Granola! I comes to a fork in the road with a spoon in my nose. Now I got a plate in my head.
What's going on? You gotta draw the line somewhere.
This is Adam Shartoff. And you're listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. Welcome to episode number 259. Thank you for tuning in. I got a lot of nice feedback on episode number 258 with Robert Longstreet. I think it's a funny episode, and it's an unpredictable episode, and you don't even have to really be super familiar with Robert to really appreciate that. So if you haven't heard it yet, go back and listen to episode number 258, everybody. You know, you can find the show on iTunes, of course. I always say if you're going there, go and subscribe, and you know, leave us a star rating and a comment if you're so inclined. I appreciate it. But you can also find us on the Rooftop Films website in their blog menu. You can find all the episodes going back to episode number one, as you can on iTunes. And you can find the current episode on my website, filmwaxradio.com. Just an FYI. Today was a great day. I grew up in the 1970s in New York City, and my parents, when I was growing up as a teenager, what have you, they were nuts for films, and they were kind of snobs about it, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but they were film snobs, which is a good thing. You know, any art or discipline requires a certain part of the population behind it to be especially scrutinizing, you know, and let's face it, I mean, Bergman, or as they say in Sweden, Bergman, was certainly always considered one of the world cinema's greatest auteurs, and my parents used to see his films with regularity, just every time there was a new film, they would either see it in the theater. And actually, another way was, this is really just on the cusp of home video. So even before that, PBS would play a lot of world cinema, you know, on their station on WNET in New York. So they were crazy for Bergman. And, I of course, as a young kid, didn't really get it. So it wasn't until I was in college, and I went to Bard College, and I took a film history class, and they showed Persona, and among other films, they showed Persona. And I kind of really wish now I was as much into film as I am now, or even a few years back, because I think I would have really just have eaten it up a little bit more. But I saw Persona, and it really was rather amazing, you know? It was deep. I knew that this was about the human psyche, about people being alienated from one another, about loneliness, about depression, all those great things Scandinavians do so well. I also got to remember one early film that the family went out to see. We went to see, of course, Sound of Music and Planet of the Apes and all these films. But we also went out and saw The Immigrants. And I guess if you are a film fan right now, you know where I'm leading. I got to meet today the actress Liv Ullmann. Not just actress, but filmmaker, because she's made 5 films, as it turns out. And this is her 5th one. It's coming out in a few days. And I'm going to put up another episode later this week with that. But I just wanted to mention, I did speak with Liv Ullmann. She has a new film again called Miss Julie with Jessica Chastain. Anyway, so she's in it. Colin Farrell is in it and Samantha Morton. And so, but we're going to talk to Liv Ullmann, and that'll be on the next episode. But I just thought, I'm just reeling coming off that and just sitting there. I'm sitting just inches from her, flirting with her. So you'll hear that on the next episode. Speaking of the 70s, even going back further, while Ingmar Bergman was making all these very sad films about psychological suffering, here in the States, one filmmaker by the name of Bob Downey, it wasn't until years later, of course, where once there was a real Robert Downey Jr., then Robert Downey Sr. had to become Robert Downey Sr., right? A number of years ago, I went to a screening of a Hal Ashby film. I believe it was The Landlord. And who was at the Q&A afterward but Robert Downey Sr., because he was friends with Ashby. So that was the first time I had a chance to see Robert Downey Jr.'s Robert Downey Sr. in person. And afterwards, I came up and I introduced myself. Flash forward about, 7-8 months ago. And I'm walking through Union Square in Manhattan. And I pass Robert Downey Sr. on, just walking right by me. And then I get past him, thinking, what are you doing? Go back and find him and get him on the show. So sure enough, I ran back, I backtracked, and there he was. I said, I ran up to him, and I accosted him, and I said, excuse me, Mr. Downey. And he turned around, and he was very, not really surprised. I suppose this happens from time to time. And I said, listen, I do this podcast, blah, 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 and I went into it. And, after, a month of phone calls, he doesn't have email. So we got together and did the podcast in his apartment in Manhattan. And I just have to mention, because I have to, this is a guy who's made all these underground films, as they were called then. But, and those in the underground knew all about Bob Downey. But the one film that he made that has sort of sustained itself in the pop culture is his film Putney Swope, which was definitely a satire on race relations, on advertising, on politics, and it is a hoot. So I have some connections with the Criterion Collection, and some time ago I picked up a box set that they have, and it's still available. Within the Criterion Collection, there is a series called the Eclipse series. So if you're looking for it, that's how you can find it. They have the Eclipse series. I think this is volume 33. It's called Up All Night with Robert Downey Sr. And included in this box set is Babbo 73, Chafed Elbows, No More Excuses, Putney Swope, and 2 tons of Turquoise to Taos Tonight. So pick it up. And that's my plug for the Criterion Collection, who have been very kind and do occasionally supply me with a DVD or Blu-ray or something like that. Anyway, so thank you to them. Now, let's see, what can I say? Met in his apartment, was very well taken care of. He had all sorts of nice treats out, and we talked for a good hour and a half, I forget. You're going to hear a good chunk of that conversation. It was a very hot day, one of the hottest days of the summer, but we were very comfortable sitting inside, and he was couldn't have been more generous. And I can't wait to call him and let him know that I put the show up. So, and I almost forgot to mention, this is a good thing. CineFamily in Los Angeles is doing a retrospective on the films of Robert Downey Sr. It's called Truth and Soul, Inc., The Films of Robert Downey Sr., and then in parentheses, A Prince. I'm not sure what that is, but it's the first annual Friends of Cinema Family Weekend fundraiser, and in person is good friends of Robert Downey Sr., Paul Thomas Anderson, Louis C.K., and if that's not enough, Robert Downey Jr. will also be in attendance. I'm not sure what's available as I record this introduction, but please do check it out. If there's any chance you can get over there, do that. So basically, the month of December is going to be about Robert Downey Sr. So it all starts on Friday, December 5th, as mentioned. Then they're going to do, you know, all sorts of other events on the 6th. They've got things on the 7th, 8th of December, and then picking up again on the 13th, I see. You got to go to the calendar. Go to cinefamily.org. That's cinefamily.org. Check out all that the stuff that's going on to pay heed and tribute to Robert Downey Sr. And right now, here is my conversation paying heed to the one and only Robert Downey Sr. And we'll be back afterwards. Don't miss that either. There's two names that come up a lot after Robert Downey, of course. And one of them, of course, is Altman. Do you know who the other filmmaker would be that all these independent young filmmakers, not just only young ones, but...
Jarmusch?
No. A little older.
Paul Anderson.
No, older. Older. And gone. Dead. Cassavetes.
Oh, yeah, I knew John. Yeah, he was a sweetheart.
Yeah. I know. You see him in the end of the last films, and it's like, it's almost, he got that distended.
Yeah.
Distended and everything, yeah. I saw they were also re-releasing that movie, his last Loves, maybe it's Love Streams, or one of those last films that he did, and I'm like, I almost wish that hadn't come out.
Which one was it?
That's the one where he and Jenna are brother, and they play brother and sister, actually.
Oh, Love Streams.
Yeah.
I found some of it amusing. I know both. I don't know her that well, but I know him.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting they play brother and sister.
Yeah, it's right. That is odd. I don't. And they were apparently still in love. So.
Well, listen. The great thing about him is he found a way to make his own films. By being an actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask you, I saw you in To Live and Die in L.A. I watched that recently again, or maybe for the first time, actually. I love Friedkin, of course, another one of the greats, of course. But I noted you were listed as an actor in it. You were great.
I was all right.
No, you were really good. You were really good. I mean, it wasn't like you were a role that you had a ton to do with, in the role. But I thought, you were 100% convincing, and you really sort
as a cop.
Yeah, but as great. A pencil pushing cop, or as a desk.
Yeah.
Desk. But yeah, you did, and of course, you look the type, and it was good. It was good casting.
Well,
how did that happen?
Editor of that is a guy who cut three of my films, and he produced To Live and Die in L.A. So I was walking down the street up near Bloomingdale's, and I bumped into Friedkin, and he said, I'm making a movie. You want to be in it? I said, what would I do? And he says, don't worry about it. I'm going to bring you out to California and have some fun, and we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did it.
Did you have fun?
Yeah.
Then he lived up to his side of the bargain.
I got to see my kid and that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. It was a great cast.
Willem Dafoe.
John Turturro.
Yeah. I forgot that. Yeah.
Yeah. What's his name? William Peterson?
Yeah.
Really amazing cast. And they were pretty unknown at the time.
That's right.
Guys.
All of them.
You were probably the veteran on,
on
that
the
set.
Oldest.
Yeah, on that set, right? Well, thank you for making time for this.
Oh, no problem.
Appreciate it.
I just finished working on something, so I have time.
What is it? Something you can talk about, or is it you wrote something?
Yeah.
I think when I ran into you in Union Square, which is where I, right in front of there, I where I pled my case about and you were even right there. You said you would do it. You had mentioned something about that, and you said that you had been maybe wrestling with something for a while, and then finally figured it out.
Years, yeah, finally got it.
Yeah,
finally had it make sense.
That's
fun.
Yeah. So you finished?
I'd put it this way. This is the draft I'm going to give to people to try and raise money.
Great.
But it's never done.
No.
But it feels real good, so we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Could you direct it?
Oh, of course.
You would?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Otherwise, I wouldn't write it.
It's
too hard. Screenplays are an unnatural act.
Yeah. Would it have to be an indie film?
This one's a little more, could be anything, depending on who I get, mm-hmm. you know, to play in it.
Mm. What's the...
no genre. None.
No, it defies genre. That's,
yeah.
Well, so it's in fitting in with your oeuvre of work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's been a few years since you've directed anything.
Documentary down in Philadelphia.
Rittenhouse Square.
Yeah, I had fun with that. And the guy that I worked with was great.
Who did the cinematography, you mean?
Or no, Max Rabb, the producer.
The producer.
He also produced Walkabout.
The Australian film?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, and he also produced Clockwork Orange.
Never heard of it. That's an amazing story. How'd you get him to work on... for those who haven't seen, this is a documentary about the famous park. I don't know who designed it. I only know the people who designed our parks here in New York, generally Frederick Olmsted and those guys. But this is one of the oldest parks in the country. Nice meeting you. Hopefully I'll see you again.
Nice meeting you.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
Yeah.
You should
lucky. I got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back.
We'll be back with Bob Down. I mean, how does it feel for you?
Well, I can tell you.
How does it feel for you to when like somebody comes up to you and you know, like I did?
Well, I'll equivocate that with a film forum, which I'd never had a film shown at. And this past year, they showed two of my films in something called New York YAWK Cinema. And I went down there thinking, I'm so glad to finally have made it to this theater, which I love. And I was waiting for one film to empty out after something that I was going to do. No, I was waiting to do a Q&A after one film and introduce another one and then come back for a Q&A.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't expect anybody to be in the theater. It was packed and it was insane. And they were young and I was blown out. I didn't know what happened. So there's something... But some of these films, they might be 40, 50 years old, but they know them.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, well, in a city like New York, it's not so hard to find a few hundred people that are going to be aware of your films and really know your place in the history of films here in the United States anyway, and come out for something like that. That's why I went to, one of the reasons I went to that Hal Ashby retrospective
at
the BAM when you were there. That's how I first met you. Well, I won't say met, but I came up to you afterwards, and I'm sure after a lot of people.
Well, that was nice. He was a dear friend. That's a tragedy. He was way too young to die.
Yeah.
59.
Yeah, that is. It's too close to my age now.
Not close to mine, though.
No. Well, yeah, that Ashby... You talk about a case of somebody putting out again, like Cassavetes and these other guys we've been talking about. Even if they don't, I don't know, what they put, it's definitely a quality thing, not necessarily always quantity, but what they created was magnificent and, you know.
Well, he was a very positive guy, and he really cared about screenwriting, even though he didn't do it. If he had a script that he found something interesting, and he'd call you up and read it to you. About a couple of pages, see what you thought, that kind of stuff. And very funny.
Was he?
Oh, God, yeah.
I remember Nick Dawson, who you brought up at the beginning, wrote the book.
The book was great.
And yeah, he did. It's amazing. And then I went to hear him talk and introduce one of the Ashby, maybe it's the one you were there for, but and I was like, this is Nick Dawson, this is this young British... I expected
he wasn't born when Hal Ashby was.
I know, but he's one of those freaks of nature.
He met his wife while he was researching it in the library.
Is that right?
That's where he first met her.
Let me find out that library. I need to.
That's good.
Well, let's go back into your career since I'm talking to you. We've talked about everybody but you. And we touched a little bit on your most recent project, which was Rittenhouse Square, but we didn't even get that far into that. Just to go back, you know, actually, I have this as a reference, which I got when this first came out,
about two years ago, right?
Yeah, probably this. When I'm saying this, I'm referring to the Criterion Collection's Robert Downey Sr. Films, including Babbo 73, Chafed Elbows, No More Excuses, Putney Swope, and Two Tons of Turquoise, Dow's Tonight.
Tows.
Yeah, I guess it should be alliteratively consistent, right?
Yeah.
Were you... first of all, let me ask you a couple of questions to keep interrupting myself, but you grew up in New York? Where'd you grow up, in Brooklyn?
No, a little bit on Long Island when I was very young, and then Army, then back to New York, Greenwich Village. I'm basically, in a way, a New Yorker from two or three places close by.
Mm. Where in Long Island was that?
Huh?
Where in Long Island did you grow up?
I was in Garden City at St. Paul's Prep School until I didn't get thrown out of that one. I was thrown out of another one in New Jersey, Petty. That one.
Okay.
Baldwin with my grandparents for quite a while. And then basically into the Army just to get away at 16 underage. Mm-hmm. And my mother signed me in. She couldn't wait.
Oh, really? God. Not World War II. Korean War, yeah. And so let me ask you, when you were growing up there, I can't imagine you had a ton of exposure to cinema. So,
oh, no.
Right? So, yeah. Back then, did you have the idea to be...
No, I was just a drunk when I was in the Army, and I had no idea about film or anything like that.
Yeah. What did you want to do back then? I mean, did you even think about it? Drink.
Just stay out of the stockade as much as possible.
Did you manage that?
Well, I finally served enough time where they could let me out without a dishonorable, but close to it. Mm-hmm. And I came back here. I checked in with my sister in the village, and I wandered over to a place on... By then, I was writing a little bit. I got to a place on called the Charles Theater. Did you ever hear of this?
No.
On Avenue B.
And I was thinking Charles Street on the west side, but go ahead.
No, it was a Charles Theater. It was a big place, and what they did every year, they had you bring a film in, and you put it on a pile in the projection booth. And you wait your turn. It could be days until your film showed. And I was fascinated by all the films I saw. I just would sit there. I'd go to eat, come back, or whatever.
Did they tell you, when your film was going to come out, or you just had to watch everything?
You kind of could find out as a rumor you'll be up today.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was. And so I started making shooting in 16.
16 millimeter?
Yeah. And I got lucky. A couple of early films got great reviews. they were in the village and from The Voice, and then finally the New York Times had a big thing about Chafed Elbows where they didn't hate it and they said a couple of nice things, and then it was crowded down there. And then from then on I was not able to raise money easily, but I could think of another film.
Was that the one that Chafed Elbows, was that the one where you mostly use photographs?
Stills,
right. And then a little
motion.
Yeah.
But mostly stills interrupted by live action.
Had you seen that style before?
No.
Like Chris Markers? I don't know.
No, I haven't seen that film yet, and it was on a double bill somewhere.
Chris Markers?
Yeah. I've heard of him. He's not one of the guys I know much about. I know mostly about Godard and Truffaut.
That generation?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah. Since you bring him up, did they have much of an impact on you? There's a new wave filmmaker?
Yeah, 1960, Breathless, yeah. Mm-hmm. 59, yeah.
Did you see those around the time you're talking about, where you started to...
I began to say, geez, look what else you can do.
So making something that was not conventional appealed from you pretty much from the beginning?
Yeah.
Making a conventional narrative did not appeal to you?
I wouldn't know how.
Yeah?
I wouldn't have known how.
But it's interesting because, so it wasn't like this intentional decision to make like what we would call experimental film or underground films.
Well, I kind of know because Jonas Mekas in The Voice came out for the film. He was definitely experimental.
Oh, yeah.
But he came out for him and talked about how fun they were and this and that. So that really was a big help.
Yeah.
He's still here.
I know. I acted in a movie with his daughter.
I don't know about his daughter.
She's pretty beautiful and very talented. Her name's Una.
What does she do?
She's an actress in L.A.
Oh, okay.
And you would meet her. I just happened to be a friend of mine made a movie, and he asked me to be in it for some reason. And then I noticed that one of the other people that was on an email was named Una Mekas. And I said, when I met her and we read together, I said, are you related to Jonas Mekas? She says, my dad. And he must have been 60 when he had her because he's like 90.
That's right.
And she's young.
She's doing okay?
Yeah. She directed a short and they showed it at the Film Anthology Archives.
She
had a screening there.
Does she work as an actress?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know her whole story. We're not close, but.
Oh, I see.
I mean, I can call her up if I had to.
Yeah. He was.
He has a son,
too. Village Voice, he was the mainstay for everybody who wanted to make films that are personal. He was the guy that you just hope saw the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nowadays, we talk about New York is, this is a popular spot to make films because, there's this whole other industry that's an alternative to the Hollywood system. But when you were here, I mean, and you were making these films that I named from this like box set here, there was no distribution system and there was nothing. I don't know what you were thinking.
Well,
I mean, thank God you were.
There was a co-op.
Yeah.
And then there was Cinema 16, but that was mainly for college bookings and stuff like that. But there was one distributor called Cinema 5. A guy named Don Rugoff, who owned all the theaters, his family, from the Cinema 1, 2, 3, the Beekman, the Paris.
And the Upper East
Side. There's about four more. He owned them all, and he started distributing, and he distributed Costa Gavras, Trash, and then he grabbed Putney Swope when nobody else wanted it. And it's a funny story. I'll never forget it. He brought in the ad for the film with that up Madison Avenue thing.
Yeah.
And he said, what do you think? I said, it's better than the movie. He said, don't ever say that again.
Right. And you're not good at publicity.
Huh?
You weren't that good at publicity then.
No. He was a lovely guy. He loved movies. I think Coppola might have bought his company at one time. Then he faded out. But he had a list of like 40 films, and they were all interesting or tried to be anyway. So he... By him taking my film, it helped other filmmakers come to him who thought he'd never take their film.
Yeah.
In fact, the guy who made Trash called me up and said, what do you think? I said, get over there in a hurry. Don't even question it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he opened the film. I think he saw it, say, on a Wednesday, and four Wednesdays later, it was in the movie house.
Wow. So
your poster.
Putney Swope. Putney Swope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, because that was, yikes, because that film.
Well, it had
connected.
Distribution.
Yeah.
I told you, he distributed films, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he pushed it all around the country. He had Z, remember that one?
Sure, Costa Gavras.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which I saw Costa Gavras about a month and a half ago at the Human Rights Festival.
Oh, here?
Yeah.
In town?
Yeah.
At the Lincoln Center?
Lincoln Center. He spoke.
I
hadn't seen him in ages. Lovely guy.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Think you'd do this show? All right.
Yeah.
Two questions. One is like some of your other contemporaries then that you got to know, and then also were people starting to, they were discovering the films then. They were coming out. There was an audience for this. Hal Ashby.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's how we met at a screening of a Putney Swope.
It was here?
He was going with my stepfather's daughter. And she said, you got to go see this thing. I was in California, and we met, and that's where we became friends. And he hadn't made a film yet. He'd edited a lot of films.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think Norman Jewison was his main director, and he edited all his films. And Norman Jewison came to the landlord, and he didn't have time for it, so he said, Hal, you want to direct? And Hal said, yeah. He said, you've been saving my ass a lot. This is for you, and that's how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then Hal, you know, Harold and Maude and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Last Detail, great film.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And he helped a lot of other filmmakers, too. When he got busy, he would try and get your script sold to the company he was working at and not even care if they got made or not because he liked them.
Mm-hmm.
He was that kind of guy.
Yeah. It was still at a time where they were making these very personal movies and getting them into, like, you know, major opportunities for major distribution for these films that wouldn't happen so much today.
Well, it depends on what you call experimental or what's...
Not even talking about experimental. Kind of just personal. I mean, a film like Harold and Maude.
Well,
Lamont
things got personal in the 70s.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That's right. That's what you
got
mean.
Got less personal a little later is all.
And now I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Well, and now they're selling, you know, less dialogue, more action. They're making it for China. And, you know, well... I shouldn't. I'm not criticizing. You've got family members who are probably involved in some of those movies. So, respectfully.
Well, he just made his own film. He produced one.
Mm-hmm.
And broke the cycle of sequels, and with Robert Duvall and he. I haven't seen it, but
wow.
I have good high hopes for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he's thinking about directing his own stuff sometime.
He should.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, certainly the clout to do it, so it'd be great.
That's right.
You know, it would be great. But Putney Swope was, because of distribution, it connected with audiences a lot, and it was a satire of the advertising industry.
That's some of it, yeah.
Some of it.
The reason that film had a big audience is that Jane Fonda was on the Johnny Carson show talking about Easy Rider, her brother's film.
Right.
And I guess Johnny Carson said something, and she said, well, wait, there's another film I got to talk about. And so she mentioned Putney Swope, and you got to go see it. I thought that was great. And sure enough, because of her, the box office went up all over the country the next night.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, just that. And then I went on there a couple of times.
Did you?
Yeah. And
Who booked you? I mean, who would have booked this guy?
Well, this guy Rugoff at Cinema 5 had a publicity department.
Right.
Or hired publicists. And they would put me on the Carson show, the Cavett show, whatever.
Yeah.
And on that, by then, it was not like the box office would go up, but it wouldn't go down.
Uh-huh.
So this
was that when, like, there was like a 90-minute Tonight Show, and it was like they would bring on more.
Well, it was in New York.
Yeah, right. Still, mm-hmm.
I would have loved to have gone on with Jane Fonda without her talking about the. I've never met her.
Yeah, still she looks dynamite.
Powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about a politically serious person, although she was criticized a lot.
Yeah, Hanoi Jane.
That's it.
Yeah, kind of sidetracked her for a little bit. Not very long, I mean, you know.
No.
She's certainly gotten a lot more when she married Turner. She was gone for a real long time.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I've liked a lot of her movies since she's returned, but still nice to see her working again.
Yeah.
You know.
Instead of doing an exercise tape.
Yeah, I like those two.
Those were all right.
She was a pioneer in that industry as well, so think what you may, but... She figured something out, right?
That's it.
You know, if you can figure something out, I mean, I would sell exercise tapes.
She had to do what she was going to make you watch.
Yeah, right, exactly. I like those leg warmers. You know, they were popular, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, so what you were always in New York? Did you try?
Well, no,
you went to L.A. for a while,
years out in L.A.
Yeah.
That's not fun out there.
Yeah.
And then...
What's not fun about it?
My son was going through his stuff. I wouldn't leave there. I stuck in.
Uh-huh.
Held in.
Yeah.
But I think I can give you the essence of Los Angeles in a little moment I had out there. I'd come home really wasted one night in Pacific Palisades, and I got out of the car and walked to the house next door and went in.
To the wrong house.
Yeah. Now... I realize, well, I'm in the wrong house, and there's a guy watching TV in the living room who hasn't heard me yet. I was quiet, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to get killed if this guy has a gun. So I'm backing out, and he turns around, and he says to me, you never say hello. And to me, that was L.A. From then on, I did. Because how you doing?
Yeah. Oh, so I thought you never say hello. He figured out that you accidentally walked into his house.
I don't know what he figured, but yeah. To me, that's the comment.
Right,
you
right.
Never say hello.
Not like, what the fuck are you doing in my house?
Right.
It's funny. Or like, oh, I thought you were my wife or something. You know, it's like who walked maybe in and doesn't say hello. But I he did mean you because
yeah,
you just were being in.
It was jarring.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
Sobered me up. Got me a little sober.
So when you say you were wasted, I thought you were tired, but you were drunk.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I don't drink much, so it was really bad.
Yeah. That's never been an issue for you?
The other stuff was an issue, but not booze.
Okay.
When I was a kid in the Army, it was the only thing we could get.
Booze. Yeah. So how many years did it take to make all these films then that were all your kind of the main part of your output was
63 to 73 is that group.
Right.
With another one called Pound that's not on there, and Greaser's Palace.
Greaser's Palace, which was the quote-unquote acid western that you made.
Supposedly.
Yeah. What were you trying to attempt with that one?
Have fun.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a fun production, and that went out, I assume, in theaters.
Well, Don Rugoff put that one out, and had the producer book a theater here, and then when there was no distribution after that, he took it over, and he sent it around the country, and actually it's been on Turner Classics.
Has it?
2 a.m. and Putney Swope, 2 a.m. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
That channel must be desperate.
For content.
For something.
For something to play these movies in the middle of the night. But soon, as we know, at the time, people aren't really watching things on other people's schedules anymore. I mean, now we kind of watch everything on demand, and that's one reason podcasts have become as popular as they have is because, you know, you don't have to... What time is the radio show on NPR? It's on at 4:30. I'll wait by my radio and turn it on.
When is it on? Yours?
No, you can get
you
it
just
when you
search
want
it.
To. Yeah, you basically the way it works is, it's on the internet, and then you can subscribe to it, and so it goes to your phone if you have a phone that can play like a smartphone, like an iPhone or something, or if you have a tablet, or you can do it on your computer. But the point is that you can listen to it anytime you want to.
But when does it go on?
Once you set it up.
When do you decide when it is available?
Well, I tried to keep with the schedule. Like, I put a new show up every Wednesday.
You do that much? Every Wednesday?
Just about. Yeah. It's like I have tons of...
So you're on the case.
I like to talk to, you know, I'm like, it's for me, it's really fun. And, you know, I'm always learning. And
you ought to talk to Jonas Mekas.
You know, I have a list, and he's been on that list since I started that list because... No, it's not that. It's like I do know his daughter. I could ask her to, you know. I've met him a few times. I've gone to a few events, and he's been there. In fact, when his daughter screened her first directorial short, she directed the short, and her dad let her use the theater to play it for an invitation.
He better.
Yeah, exactly. The very least, right? And he was there, but I've met him a few times. But you know, he's. I don't know that he would be an easy person to talk with. You know, like. In this way, I don't know. But I've had on, you know, Al Maisels. I've had on Pennebaker and his wife, Chris Hedges. And, you know, William Friedkin, actually, I talked to him, but it was on the phone because he was in L.A. It was right before.
I know him.
Yeah. It was right before he came here to do the, there we did a retrospective of his stuff at.
And he wrote a book, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
a good crazy character.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, he went off on the subject of evil. You know, he talked about the force of evil, and, you know, it's one of these subjects, I guess, that interest him. It was right after one of these school shootings that these little kids got killed.
Oh, like Columbine and one of those?
It was not that one, but it was one much more recent where some kids in a schoolyard were, you know, just tragic. But he, so we talked about that because it was just, it happened. And then we were talking about The Exorcist and how I remember when I was a kid and that came out, how, people were talking about how people were getting sick and having nervous breakdowns after watching it, and that it was, a lot of it was hype, of course, but.
Yeah, exactly.
But he swore that it wasn't the studios weren't behind that they didn't try to hype it that way,
if
that it
they
was
get
media.
Caught telling the truth, they'll lie their way out of it. Please.
Well,
L.A., I mean, please.
So you're pretty cynical about L.A. and about the whole scene.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. What about television? Have you ever been interested in...
I actually directed a pretty famous television show for Joe Papp, mm-hmm. called Sticks and Bones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And
we talked about that on the phone a little bit.
Yeah. And
David Rabe.
It got thrown off the air because what we did is take an hour out of his play, then take the bear down to the bare bones and turn it into a horror show, mm-hmm. about a returning guy from, obviously, Vietnam, who's blind, whose parents talk him into suicide. That's what it is.
Yeah, it's a musical comedy, right?
Well, it was on Broadway.
No, I know. I saw it at the Tap Theater.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I think I mentioned, my parents dragged me to this play. Can you imagine?
That's great.
Yes, in retrospect. At the time, not so happy about it.
So, Pap asked me to do it, and we had a great time doing it.
Uh-huh.
And then when CBS wouldn't show it, he said, watch this. And he goes out in front of the CBS building and is interviewed and says that CBS, who has a contract with him, mm-hmm. are cowards. They won't play Sticks and Bones. Well, what had happened was they hadn't read it because he just sent Shakespeare and this. And
what year was this?
Huh? 72. And so the returning guys from Vietnam heard about it, and they were complaining that this thing had been thrown off the air. And next thing you know, it was thrown back on with no commercials on a network. So it was quite a night. So that was fun.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
like, so it played on CBS?
Yes.
Without commercial interruption?
None.
Sticks and Bones.
Yeah.
One of the more controversial plays coming out of the public theater in those days.
And when we wanted to take it away from comedy, because it was a satire of Ozzy and Harriet, and we eliminated all those names and just made the stark thing of what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you remember who was in it?
Yeah, Tom Aldridge, who's gone now, and what's her name? Married to Eli Wallach.
Oh, Ann Jackson. Ann Jackson.
She was the mother. Cliff DeYoung, another actor, played the kid coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. It's a very small cast.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there are other little people around here and there. But it was really wild to sit in a motel to make sure it was really on the air. I wouldn't have trusted my own TV. And it was helpful to the returning guys from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
No, that was great. I love Joe Papp, and he was funny, too. Again, very funny.
Very driven.
He's everything, but since he hadn't done much television, he was open to trying anything. If you say you wanted to shoot it all, you know, in this way or that way, if it sounded interesting to him, he'd say, yeah, go ahead. So he was a great producer.
Yeah, that theater really, well, he changed theater.
He got it for a dollar.
He got
building.
The He did?
Yeah, from the city.
Oh. Yeah, I'm sure. Well, that area was considered a slum when he moved in there, right?
Right. Plus, he was giving Bowery. Shakespeare away, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
Then he started having hits on Broadway, or stuff that he developed out at the Public, like Hair. He started that.
Right.
And then three or four other things that were big money makers.
Chorus Line.
That's what... At one time, I wanted to take my kids to Chorus Line. He said, no, don't do that. I said, why? He said, that pays for the good stuff. You don't want to corrupt them. I said, wait a minute, Joe. They want to go see it. And he said, well, they can go. I'll get you tickets, but don't you go.
You went.
No, I didn't.
You didn't go.
No, my wife took me.
Because my parents took me to that, too. It was at the Public when I saw it the first time.
Yeah, because it was workshopped.
I saw it was a I know it was workshop there, but it was they ran performances as as a as an off-Broadway production as well. And I was at 9 years old or whatever year, because I think it was 73 or 74, and I was like blown away. Even as a guy said, this isn't like showboat or Music Man. This is like these were people that we
were telling their stories.
Yeah,
the movie was a disaster. I saw it.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I never saw that.
It looked like a play and a movie.
Yeah, that's always lacking a vision. Like if you're going to do it, refigure it out.
Yeah.
You got to refigure the screen. Do something. Yeah, try. So before, when you, one of the first things that you mentioned was about how people watch films now, which is not necessarily in theaters anymore, or just, yeah, well, right, your point. He just pointed at these,
not,
these
that's
DVDs.
That's not that stable now.
No. These may be in our, may go out of business, or rather may fade away, right, as a technology. Like, they're making these, but none of people are necessarily buying them anymore.
I was surprised at how the this did. Again, it's on a separate label at Criterion called Eclipse.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and
it did well? Is that what you're saying?
It is doing, and was.
Okay.
When it started.
What do you owe that to?
To them.
The marketing department.
Well, they do a great job of presenting stuff that looks good and is clean and... The place is like a cathedral for film. You ever been up there?
Yes.
Well, then you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they really care.
I try not to go up there because it's just, it's too, it's nearby. But it's too, it's like you're a kid in a candy shop, but you can't buy any candy or something, or you have no teeth, or I don't know. But I want to raid the vault.
Well, every time I go there, they take you into the closet.
Yeah.
You heard about this?
Yes. Yeah, I want to be in the closet. Absolutely want to go in the closet. It's true. I don't know what it is about it, but I do covet that. Maybe after this, maybe they'll see how those guys over there at Criterion, they'll know how dedicated I am. Yeah, no, it's. I'm glad to hear that people are getting it. But you're right. I think. Well, they have that website that streams movies, Hulu, and a lot of the Criterion. Do you know about it? Where you can go to this website and they have a screen, a player, like a movie player. You know, like YouTube or. I'm just talking about. It's high definition, and you can subscribe for a certain amount every month, and then you get they have the if not the entire Criterion collection, they have most of it up there.
Really?
So yeah, so because they have a deal with this Hulu website, and I'm pretty sure your stuff is on there, so people can watch it on at home or on cable. If they have a device now that you can play cable streaming from the internet on your TV.
It's hard to keep up with all of it. Did a wonderful bunch of extras for The Leopard. Lancaster is in it.
Yeah, no, I know that one.
I forgot the famous director.
It's not Bertolucci. No.
Older
it's
guy.
Not De Sica. It's Visconti.
That's right.
Visconti.
Good pull. What a bunch of extras.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I got to get that one.
Yeah.
Sometimes the extras are better. I watch them
first.
Yeah? Well, especially if you've seen it already. I have to admit that when I saw To Live in Die in L.A., the better version was the one where Friedkin's talking over it. They had that. It's a decent enough film, but more for the appearance, like these special actors that are in it, including, I'm not just saying this, but including yourself, but when you watch it with Friedkin telling anecdotes over the whole thing, it's like, great. I could listen to him talk for hours. He's such a good storyteller.
Yeah, he's good at that.
Yeah. And he would, when he was at that BAM thing, when he signed that new memoir you were referring to, that he couldn't even sit down. He would just had to get up and pace the stage and talk to people and, like, get as close to the edge of the stage and connect with people. He just loves that, It's amazing.
Well, he directs operas, too.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, a bunch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But live,
in
L.A.? No, around the must be
all
just
over
around
the world.
It's incredible.
Yeah, who would have figured that To Live and Die in L.A. is French Connection?
Right.
There's never been a better cop movie than The French Connection, and there never will be. He caught it.
Yeah, no, that's the best. I couldn't even talk to him about that movie when I had him on the phone for this podcast. I didn't even bring it up because. I would need to talk to him for, ever about it. It's like one of those movies that are just so rich and full of nuance and you know, are so special. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So even though you were always making these, what we'll categorize as underground cinema or...
Yeah, that's what it was called.
Yeah. But you also had, you just didn't have to make more conventional.
Yeah, well, I loved a lot of even Hollywood films, mm-hmm. but mainly, you know, French.
Right.
Whatever was
Italian.
Good. Whatever was different.
Whatever's good.
Yeah.
Do you still go out to see movies very frequently? Or
once in a great while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Something will catch your. You'll just a friend.
Yeah,
will
I
mention.
Want to go to the film forum, and I don't want to wait and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But to go to like a big bleacher type joint to watch a film, whatever they call those large cinemas.
Yeah, like IMAX. You mean?
That kind of? No, that I don't mind because the images are so great. Stadium seating, they
oh,
call it.
Oh, stadium seating. Okay.
Oh, is that painful? Usually, I go over here to Kips Bay, and it's okay. But there's not much great over there. It has to be something that we have to see. I can't wait.
Right.
Usually, I can wait now.
And you just watch it here at home?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you just and you're watching it on cable as opposed to, right? Yeah.
Or on demand, or some of these things are on before the day they open.
Right. Yeah, that's a kind of a becoming a that's a hot topic for a lot of people in the industry. The theater owners, you know, for a lot of these films that go on demand same day, don't want to play those movies. They look like it's cutting into their business
oh,
as theater
because
People aren't going to go to the theaters. Whether that's true or not, the jury is out. Like, if it's really harming their business or not. I imagine for some, it would be. Like, if you've got a small theater and that's not in the middle of a city, and somebody can just rent the movie at home, they're going to probably do that.
What do you think's going to happen? They're going to turn those down?
Well, they are turning them down in a lot of cases.
They are.
But there was just an article I read about that where they interviewed a number of theater owners and distributors about it. And, you know, it seems like they're divided. I mean, you know, they're not doing that with the big Hollywood tentpole movies, but they could show that on, I mean, I don't think it would hurt their business. They could show that on cable the same day. I don't think it would hurt their business and the theaters. The theaters are people are going, they're going to those for those movies. That's not the issue. It's the other movies. You know, the
same day.
Sarah Polley movies, you know. Yeah, in those
cases.
That was
some movie she made about Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was
Did you
great.
See Stories We Tell?
Yeah.
That's when
Nick and I had no sound.
No. Oh, well she did
we
the one about the Alzheimer's with Julie. No, she did the one with Julie Christie, which was where away from her.
Right.
Is that what it's called? Where she gets Alzheimer's or has Alzheimer's. And then she followed up with that documentary about her dad and her
right,
family.
That's the one we were Stories interviewing we her on.
Oh, okay.
What'd you make? Down in a hotel here, and I thought we had a great interview, and then there was
I'm sure
no
it was.
Sound.
I'm sure the interview was great. It's just that nobody will ever hear it. Sam.
Right.
I know, and it's hard to... It's happened to me a few times, but it's you just kind of have to do it.
Are we looking good today?
Yeah.
There's a needle...
So far, the batteries have stood this. I could tell if the batteries died because I wouldn't be able to hear anything anymore. That's why I wear these.
I just got hearing aids about a month ago. It's been a big difference.
I wouldn't have known. Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. It's good timing for me.
Yeah.
So you don't have to like.
I don't have to read your lips.
Exactly. Yeah. Were you starting to get good at that?
Not really.
No.
Getting old is nothing you want to get used to, believe me.
Yeah. Yeah. How old are you now?
78.
78? Oh, my dad's 78.
How's he doing?
He is actually doing okay. He's okay. Yeah. My mom, not so great. My mother has gotten dementia, and it's starting to...
Bad?
So it's affecting his it's bad. I mean, it's getting... She's just confused. More confused. She knows who everybody is still.
She does know who everybody is?
Yes. She does still know who everybody is, but she can't remember. She spoke Italian fluently, for instance. She doesn't know a word of Italian. They went to Italy. They would go every year. They just went, and they had to come back after a week. They were supposed to be there a month, but she couldn't. She got too anxious being away from home. She can't be out of routine, and she and She's can't communicate that well. Great, like she's losing a lot of her verbal, her basically the language. She's losing a lot of her vocabulary, and she doesn't know what things are called.
Is that her main problem?
That's the main problem, but there are other problems in terms of anxiety or stress, and you know, just she was an artist and great, amazing cook, and it's kind of all gone.
Is she able to take care of her?
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, but she'll go through several days being pretty good, and then she'll have just a wake up and feel. Be really upset, and then she'll take it out on him for the day, like an entire. And he's so stressed out because she'll, you know, she gets paranoid about it, you know, and yeah. So it's just all of a sudden this thing where she's, you know, and he's not. He could probably do more to make more radical changes, but he's afraid of doing that. You know, it's not easy getting older. You know, and it seemed and somewhat arbitrary because it could have been him. It could have been him that was like, you know, but it's her and. You know,
Alan Arkin, the actor.
Yeah,
I've known for many years.
Great actor.
I'm on the phone with him about 3 years ago, and I said, "Alan, what are you doing right now?" He lives in New Mexico. He says, "Picking up the pills I dropped yesterday." And his wife got on and said, "He's telling you the truth." And he's now 80 and working, but he's on a lot of pills.
Yeah, I mean, the last 10 years have been this
pretty good.
Yeah, it's I just saw, well, Eli Wallach, you mentioned, died recently and in the, late in the 90s, and I think he had a really good run, although about 8 years ago, I had this idea for a film, an idea, which is still, which was called Spaghetti. I called it Spaghetti, and it was about this actor who had alienated.
Leone film.
Well, yeah, it was going to all be fictional, but he... It was about an older actor who had been a New York actor, like in the 40s and 50s, like Brando and Dean and
Method.
Method. Yeah, he was like a Method New York act, but he sells out and he goes to Hollywood and he just becomes a big pompous asshole over here. This is the backstory. And finally can't get any work because he's kind of getting older anyway and he's alienated everybody. He's walked off the sets and he's made a fool of, you know. And all he can get from his agent now is a spaghetti western. And he's insulted and he doesn't want to do it. But he's finally... For personal reasons, he decides he has to get out of town and escape his personal life, and he decides to go, and he's miserable. And he goes to Spain, and they're shooting this with this crazy Italian director who doesn't speak any English. And everybody loves him because he's still a famous Hollywood. They don't know that he's been kind of
ostracized,
exactly. Anyway, so he goes there, and of course, over time, he warms up, and he has a wonderful, you know, experience, and he changes. So I wrote this letter to Eli Wallach because I thought, this is the ugly, right? Maybe he can tell me about the life on the set of a spaghetti western. And Clint Eastwood wasn't returning my calls. But I figured I could maybe reach Eli Wallach.
I know his son very well because he asked me for a copy of Sticks and Bones.
Is that right?
Yeah, like a year ago. I had a screening of something and he sent
me. Oh, he's there.
Yeah.
Well, his cousin... The son's cousin is, you know, the chief Times film critic, A.O. Scott, you know.
Oh, really?
Tony Scott, yeah. He's
he's all right as a critic.
Mm-hmm.
He's okay. Vince Camby was my favorite.
Yeah, and a big, yeah, he loved all these films we've been talking about too, right?
Most of them.
But Eli Wallach, he, coincidentally, when I wrote this letter to him, he had just was coming out with a memoir that came out. So I was able to write him via his publisher. The publisher, if it hadn't been that way, I don't know, it would have taken longer to get through, but I may have gone through Tony Scott. But the publisher sent along the letter, and one day I was upstate visiting friends, and I get a call, and it's Eli Wallach. It was surreal. And he goes, I like this idea. He called me back at work, my work, like a few days later, and he spent an hour on the phone with me.
Did you get it?
He gave me all this information. Did I write it is the question. I never finished writing the story because I just got to see. It was like, where is the story? Who's going to make this?
No,
is
but
this...
the interview with
yeah.
him. You got that?
Well, not for here.
Oh.
I wonder if I recorded it. I don't know if I recorded it. I don't recall. It's so long ago. And I don't think there was much podcasting going on then anyway. So I was in the music industry. I wasn't even doing any of this stuff yet. But he was amazingly generous for that. And then he was doing a signing, you know, somewhere in the Upper West Side of his memoir. And I said, I'm going to go and get him, get a copy and get and introduce myself, because he spent this hour plus on the phone with me. You know? So I get there and I get to the front of the line and I got my book and I say, it's Adam. Thank you so much. And he had no idea who I was. No, it wasn't because he had dementia. I think, you know, he's just an older guy. He meets tons of people. But he did call me back right before I met him. He called me a second time and he said, Adam, and he forgot that he, so he did have probably a little bit of, but he was still in amazing shape and he was still working.
His son mentioned to my friend that yeah. he and his wife have memory problems. This was about a year ago.
Oh, well, this is much longer back, but he was still, he could remember everything and his hearing was great.
I read the book on Leone, the famous book about his career and everything. Mm-hmm. It was pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know if I read that one. I wonder if I read it.
Boy, was he angry at times.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And then he kind of cooled out. Then he had memory problems, I think. I'm not quite sure, but just that how he started as an AD and and then his first film in Eastwood, yes, and all of this. It was nice.
Yeah. It's an amazing, weird, kind of almost, it's odd, the whole spaghetti western thing that happened in the first place is kind of like this weird anomaly in a way, you know, like all of a sudden these westerns were so huge in Europe, they loved them, but they were going out of vogue in the United States, you know.
That's right.
And you had all these actors and that then they were like say they were huge in Europe, they loved these guys, Lee Van Cleef,
I was going to say,
and they all had this second huge careers because they were bringing them out and they were paying them and the movies did well, and then they sold them back to the States for, you know, for people who love westerns.
Exactly.
And remember, they were made all those tons and tons. There were tons of spaghetti westerns.
Somebody Hill was another guy, an actor. Trinity, was that one of them?
Yeah, I think you're right. And
yeah,
there was
another director.
And there was Django. All those Django films, there were tons.
Yeah, he produced them.
Yes. Sergio Corbucci was, I think, unless I'm getting the wrong, there was another Sergio spaghetti western filmmaker.
There always is.
There's always another Sergio. I've used a lot of your time, but
no, yeah, don't even think that way.
No, I'm glad, but thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Same here. It was good. The next time I pass Barnes & Noble, and you come up to me, we'll do it again.
Okay.
It's important that we remember that's where we met.
It's true. I'll never forget. But I was because I had walked right by you, and I said, "Oh, Robert Downey Sr." You know, because I remembered from you from that seeing you.
From BAM.
Yeah. And I said, what do you do? Go back. Tell him. I bet he'd be a great guest. I bet he would enjoy it.
Well, I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Oh,
and now that I'm looking to go out and make films again, I better get ready for this stuff.
So when you say that, though, what's your intention? Obviously, you have this one that you're kind of done
that
with. Or
one,
that's,
and then there's another one that my wife is doing that's a webisode.
Web series.
Web series?
Yeah, they call them webisodes, but it's a web series.
Thanks.
Sure. My pleasure. I can do my bit.
And they've asked me to direct it, these two girls.
Oh, good.
And I said, sure, I will.
And you should.
They're getting closer to getting it done.
Sure. What's it called? Do you remember?
The Makeup Room.
Oh, okay. I don't know that one. It's new?
It's not anyways out of the hands yet.
Right, right.
I had the first meeting yesterday. I was there.
Oh, okay.
It's great.
It's good, right? You learn a lot, and you learn a little about this part of
storytelling. About.
Yeah, and it's storytelling, essentially the same thing that you were doing 50 years ago. And
well, I'm glad they're short.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have to have an act two and three.
Yeah. I've had a few people from web series come on, too.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I'm curious, too. You know, I'm thinking a story is a story. If you tell it well, you tell it well. If you don't, you don't. Obviously, you can spend $150 million on making a movie in Hollywood, and it could be garbage. But you could spend, you know, maybe $8,000 or $10,000, $15,000 on a web series, and it could be fabulous. So it's all in the storytelling at the end of the day.
To quote a great comedian who's rather new, the people in Hollywood who make these big films, they're not even embarrassed. That's impossible to think about people that way when you like that. You don't even know you're making crap.
Right.
And there's so much of it.
I guess you have to have an integrity or a care or...
something.
Yeah. You know, but there, you know, there are a lot of great filmmakers that are out there. I'm feeling optimistic
about it. Godard's still here.
He's still here, challenging his audiences.
And daring. Paul Anderson, who I know very well.
Do you?
Yeah. Sweetheart of a guy. But the great thing about Paul is he writes his own stuff. That's a big difference.
Sure.
Hal never wrote anything.
Well, it was a different time.
Yeah.
Also,
but I mean,
there weren't a lot. He came from a system where they didn't do that. They you
right.
know, because when he was a young guy, by the time he was a huge 70s young Turk, whatever you want to call him, he was like older by a generation than the other guys. I mean, he was at least 10, 15 years older than. I could be mistaken, than like a Scorsese
think,
or Coppola,
but I
right?
Think I think my point, if I have one, is that the films coming from out there now are not written by the same guy who directs them, except for Paul. And maybe Wes Anderson. Maybe if you have the name Anderson, that's... But I think he has a partner. Paul writes alone.
Yeah. Well, and I think...
What a gentleman he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe can, that I would love to get on, well, either Anderson, of course, but I would love to get on Paul Thomas Anderson. And I guess I'm waiting for, you know, an opportunity, somebody like that, to wait until they're not, like, doing press with a film because...
Well, he lives in California. He has three kids.
Well...
Maybe four.
Yeah, but I could go out there one point and book it.
Well,
you know,
well,
like I would,
I'll mention it to
yeah.
him.
Because what I thought would be good to do it, or I also could do it, I can actually, I have it set up where I can do Skype and record it, and it sounds pretty good. So I could even do it that way. But I was waiting for an opportunity when he's not on a film, because then you feel more...
Hype.
You have to do, well, you have to talk about the particular film, and what I want, because he's had, like, you know, what, 7, 8 films now?
No, but he would like that.
He just would, to talk about his career and about his love and film in general, and more on the broader way, like we did, rather than just get my 20 minutes and talk only about, like, you know, one film that he happens to be working with.
He interviewed me for this that was on the website at Criterion.
Yes.
He did that, and he did a great job.
So, yeah, maybe he'll be
he might,
open to being on the other, in the other seat.
He likes Criterion, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so maybe what I'll, at some point...
I'll mention it to him
sure.
that I met somebody that he might be interested in and in doing an interview with.
And do you you email, right? You obviously.
No,
oh,
I don't.
You don't?
My
you
wife
don't...
does.
Okay, okay.
If I don't even know her, I can never get her email right. So if
it's okay.
If
I could always call some other time. It's not
call and I'll give it to you right because it's near my phone book somewhere.
Understood. The only reason I bring that up is because what I could do is provide once this is done. You know, and it's I've done a little editing and I produced it and I put it, it's ready to go and it can go online. I can send her the link to how
Please.
She can listen. Then you guys can listen to it if you're interested in it, but also share that, like if
no,
you wanted
I
to
am
say.
Interested in it, I wouldn't have done it.
There you go. But I could also send it to you on a disc or something if you wanted to. That's easier for
well,
you.
I'm anxious to see what could have come out of this because I don't remember much of what we talked about.
I don't either.
None. That's good.
It's gone.
That's a good sign. That means you're thinking of the new moment.
Right, I'm in the moment. Well, and I definitely didn't come in with some list of questions
right.
on the agenda.
Thank God, I hate when...
Yeah, point by point, yes.
Pink. For Italian Westerns.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, thank you very kindly. And
you're very welcome.
And it's been a joy to come in and talk to you.
Thanks, Adam.
We had a good Thanksgiving holiday. I mean, mine was a bit strange. You know, the family's been going through so much flux. This is my mom's side. So we went down to New Jersey. I drove in the car with my dad, my mother, my son. We all went down to my mom's sister who's hosting. And I have to say, first of all, my dad is 77 years old. He's turning, I think, is he 77 or 78? He was born in 1936. My dad is 78 years old. He's in good health, but his driving, you know, he's not great anymore. He's too worried about traffic. He's too frustrated. My mother, as you may know if you listen regularly, is suffering from dementia. So she's riding shotgun and, you know, she's very bent on getting to her sister's. And so it sets up a difficult dynamic in the cars, to say the least. Anyway, we got down there okay. Got there a bit late, a lot of traffic. And then we're there. So then we're hanging out. Then we have dinner. And we all get there, and we do something we've never done before. We sit around the table, and we each say what we're grateful for, which is, you know, not an untypical thing to happen in a Thanksgiving dinner. You know, you go around the table, and you say what you're thankful for that day. That's a very, very appropriate way to celebrate Thanksgiving, you know, to accompany turkey and all the trimmings, right? So we did that. And then the conversation moves on to all sorts of things, and then on to Israel. Now, if you're in a Jewish family, this happens in your family too. I'm going to guess this is also not untypical for a Jewish family. You get on the subject of Israel, and you start fighting. Right? That happens. It's a generational thing. You know, we're all progressive Democrats. You know, we all like to think so, at least. But it seems to me that if you lived through the Holocaust, and this is such a huge exaggeration, but you're somewhat more likely as an American Jewish lefty type of person to be very pro-Israel, almost to a conservative point. But if you were born in the next generation, I guess in the 60s, 70s, what have you, and later, you are more, I suppose, sympathetic toward Palestinians. You know, look, it's a very textured, complicated subject. But you say to yourself, why is this a binary conversation? Why is it you're pro-Palestinian or you're pro-Israel? Why is it that the conversation is so black and white? Why can't it be that both sides want to exist there, even to exist without the other side? That you could just say that. You can believe that. But, of course, you know as well, intellectually, that that's not going to happen. And you know that any solution is going to be extraordinarily unpleasant, extraordinarily difficult to apply, and that there's going to be a lot of unhappy people. So there's just no way around it. It's a terrible, terrible situation, obviously, because we've been going through it for decades, my entire life. But it's the conversations around this that get so emotional and so fraught. So this year it happened, and my cousin, who is a politician, he went at it with my sister. My sister is not a political person, doesn't normally get into these conversations. But what happened was, it used to be my cousin's sister, my other cousin, Andrea, and she died in the last year or so. So she has not been around. So and they used to get into it, the brother and sister, you know, and now that's not there. So my sister, who is a few years older than I am, ended up speaking up. And instead of speaking her exactly from her own feelings, does one of those things that people that are not very comfortable talking about politics do, is they sort of speak for others. They speak for those that are angry or those that feel threatened. They don't speak their mind. They speak like kind of as an avatar for others. So it pissed the hell out of my cousin. It got very emotional, very volatile. And the next thing is, my dad then, like, gets enraged and says, you know, back off. And they're literally almost coming to blows. And so, you know, a few minutes later, everybody apologized. And actually, it became an opportunity for everybody to finally to talk. But the funny thing is it's like minutes after we went around and said how thankful for family. We are so thankful to have family. And, you know, and I believe that also those two things can coexist. You can be thankful for your family and also want to strangle them. So there is that complicated reality. It ended on a good note. In fact, we're all getting together at Hanukkah in just a couple of weeks. So there it is. We'll be back with the sequel. later this month, and I'll fill you in about that. Anyway, I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening to this episode, number 259 of Film Wax Radio. Later this week, I'm going to put up another show, everybody, because I have so many great guests. I mentioned Liv Ullmann is going to be on the program. On the same episode, I'm going to post later this week. I also have Chuck Workman, whose documentary on Orson Welles, it's called Magician, is going to is also going to be on. And then Joran Olsen, who is the filmmaker behind the new documentary Concerning Violence. It's an incredible film. And he came out a couple years back with Black Power Mixtape. I don't know if you're familiar with that film, but here's an opportunity for you to catch up on both of Joran's films. So I will have all those folks on the show on episode number 260. Hey, thank you so much for listening. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. And until next time, guys, take care. Okay, bye-bye. Every night I just want to go out and get out of my head. Every day I don't want to get up and get out of my bed. And every night I want to play out. Every day I want to do. But tonight I just want to stay in. Be with you. Every day I lean on a lamppost, I'm wasting